is March 18th, 2018, and today I'm going to offer a tribute to the late Tangen Roshi, who died last week at the age of 93. This is to precede the memorial service that we'll be doing for him after a little after the Taisho ends. Mostly I'm going to be reminiscing and also reading from others' reminiscences of Tangen Roshi. I first met him in 1979. I was there briefly at his temple in Bukokuji. I was with three others from the Zen Center. Zenson, his name at the time, Dane Gifford, Bob Schrey, and Vajra, or David Clegan. And the four of us were on a six-week pilgrimage to first India, 3 weeks in India, and then a week in Burma, and then 2 weeks in Japan. So it was just to meet, just to visit these places, pilgrimage sites, and to meet Tangen Roshi. It was a difficult first meeting because we arrived at Bukokuji late. Here's a word of warning. The word to and the word toward are very different. We had been floundering for directions at the Tokyo subway, and most people, to our surprise, were embarrassed to try out their English. And so finally we found someone. We said, "How does this train take us to Obama?" Obama is the name of the town where Bukokuji was, and we were told yes. And the train just sailed right past the Obama station, and so then by the time we got there, we were a couple hours late. And when we sat down for tea with Tangen Roshi, he said he had been there waiting for 2 hours, and so we were ready to commit seppuku at that point. And so we took a little time with him. He's very gracious. And then he said, "So would you like to have a bath?" You know, this would be standard in Japan. You've been traveling all day. And we said, "Oh, well, that'd be wonderful." And he said, "Okay, well, go ahead." It was a one-person, one of these upright traditional Japanese baths. And so we were... He told us to go ahead and, you know, one by one, have our bath. And we said, "Thank you very much. After you, Roshi." And he said, "Oh, no, no, you go ahead." We said, no, don't ask us to go ahead. No, please, you first. No, I want you to go before me. Anyway, we finally relented because we could see he was very earnest that we go before him. And we did, one by one. And, you know, the bath water gets successively less clean with each person who's taken the bath. That's one of the reasons we dreaded the thought of him going last. But we did it his way. And where did we go after each one of us, after our bath? Did we go and crawl into bed and sleep? No, we went to the Zendo. And this may or may not have been behind his insistence that we go ahead of him, because this is one way in Japan that people are motivated is through a sense of shame, of not being worthy enough. And we certainly felt we were not worthy of going before him, this esteemed master. Maybe he was finally having his bath while we were in the Zendo. It says something also about his and Japanese hospitality, that he would insist these four much younger guys go ahead of him. I'd heard from Roshi Kaplow stories about his personal time with Tangen San originally. Just a little chronology here. When Philip Kaplow, I'll call him Philip Kaplow because this was 1953 when he first went to Japan after the war. When he got to Hoshinji and met Harada Roshi, who was in his 80s at the time, what really kept him going in those very harsh conditions was the attention, the solicitousness of this young Tangen San, young monk. Hoshinji was, if you, anyone who knows from reading the Three Pillars of Zen, the sesshins there were very harsh, brutal, maybe going too far, but they were very harsh, heavy use of the stick. And Kaplow-san got there not having been sitting for more than a few weeks, so he was wholly unprepared for what he found there. They did find him a chair to help him through the first 6 months there. Otherwise, he probably couldn't manage. But another thing that helped him was the warm friendship and help of this Tangen San. Tangen San spoke enough English, not much, Roshi said, but enough English to help him with the most difficult aspects of the adjustment to Hoshinji. And just looked after him. Looked after him does not mean that he hovered over him fluttering and with concern about anything that might be difficult for this young Kaplow-san. Clearly he had a lot of faith in Kaplow-san. I think I would say especially because of the doubt mass that he could see in Kaplow. And at that time in Japan, it was almost unheard of for a Westerner to dive into one of these traditional medieval style Zen monasteries. So they knew they had someone with a remarkable need to see into his true nature. Tangen San would have seen that, even though he was relatively young at the time. And he could see that Kaplow-san was very, very motivated. But he had a lot of baggage, Kaplow did, when he got there. And we can just infer from the following story that his doksans, his early doksans with Harada Roshi, were nothing to write home about. One of the stories he told me was he was waiting in the doksan line, and Tangen San was, I guess, sitting nearby or maybe just timed it so that he got there when Kaplosan got to the head of the Doksan line. And then when Harada Roshi rang his handbell to dismiss the person ahead of Kaplosan, Tangensan clouted Kaplo in the side of the head hard, so that when Kaplo went into Doksan, he was boiling with indignation. And what he said was that Harada Roshi said, "Yosh, yosh, good, good. Finally, you're out of your head. You're finally responding from your guts." And rang him out. I'm guessing that they plotted this ahead of time. Tangensan, out of compassion for his new American friend, could see that he needed some strong medicine to get him out of his head. This is after his time at Columbia University studying academic Zen with D.T. Suzuki, and he was still very much in his head. And anyway, Roshi Kaplo recounts that with great deal of gratitude for Tangen San's insight into what he needed at that time. There was also a Sesshin later, when Kaplo had gotten more experience in Sesshin. I'm turning now to Zen merging of East and West. I think this is. I'll just recount that Doksan line thing again. I think I didn't quite get it right. At that moment, the monk. These are Kaplo's own words. At that moment, the monk, without warning, struck me violently behind the ear with his open hand. In pain and rage, I turned and swung at him. I left that out. He ducked, grabbed me by the waist, swung me around, and shoved me in the direction of the Doksan room. Yeah, and that's where he got the yosh, yosh. The first words of approval from Harada Roshi since my arrival at the monastery. But later, I'm reading here again from Roshi Kaplo's account. He says, "Pain is a strange thing. The teachers you remember with gratitude are not those who made it easy for you, but the ones who compassionately gave you a hard, painful time. After 25 years, I still feel grateful to a certain head monk," that's Tangensan, "who stayed up one whole night during Sesshin encouraging me with a stick." He describes here what the stick is. You all know that. And this was the sixth and last night of a Sesshin. After formal Zazen had ended at 9 o'clock, I found a rickety chair and took it to the bathhouse to do late night sitting. Hardly had I settled in when the stick landed with a loud crack on my shoulder. Standing over me was one of the head monks, it's Tangensan, a man who had looked after me since my arrival at the monastery and with whom I felt especially close. Although because of his demanding duties, he, like the other head monks, usually went to bed at 10 or 11, tonight, out of the deepest compassion, he was giving up his sleep to spur me on with a stick. The first hour passed, and the second, but he did not let up. As the night wore on, he stuck with me, working tirelessly, while the pain in my legs, which were braced around the sharp legs of the chair, grew even worse than the pain in my shoulders and back. Finally, overcome by the strain and exhaustion, I passed out. Upon opening my eyes, there was the monk standing beside me, holding, instead of a stick, a bowl of raw eggs. I gulped them down. The next day begins in half an hour, he said. You can rest until then. We looked at each other and silently embraced. After the session, I asked this head monk, what if I had had a weak heart and dropped dead from that all-night stick ordeal? Can't you see the papers abroad reporting middle-aged American beaten to death in Zen monastery in Japan? Zen in the West might have been set back 50 years, not to mention the repercussions in Japan. Weren't you taking a big risk? He smiled broadly. Kaplo-san, you more strong than you think. That was all he said. Going to now go back to what brought Tongan-san to the Dharma and to Zen practice. And I'll be reading from an old Zenbo. This is from the early 70s. And it's an account of a brief pilgrimage that Roshi Kaplo made there with Hugh Curran, Pat Simons, and Bob Niebel. These were three of the, certainly Hugh Curran and Pat Simons were, we used to call them the three pillars of Zen, Kaplo, Simons, and Curran. But he took them back in the early 70s to Japan to try to inspire them. And this account is by Pat Simons. We have spent the last 2 days in Kyoto visiting various temples and formal gardens, shopping for the center, and some of the shopping they did, we still have the instruments from then, shopping for the center and talking with Sensei, that's Kaplo, Sensei's friend, the monk Tongan-san, into the late hours of the night. Our conversations with Tongan-san ranged over various subjects, the most interesting of which was the story of how he got into Zen. His mother was, just summarize. His mother was a Shin Buddhist, it's a Pure Land school, not Zen. His mother was a Shin Buddhist and died while giving birth to him. She had had a premonition of her death and had prayed to the Bodhisattva Kanon to protect her baby throughout its life. Tongan-san had been made aware of this in childhood and throughout his life had felt that his mother's spirit was looking over him. Last year he fell off the mountain behind his temple and was caught by the only tree on the precipice. He told this story when I was there for my second time at Bukokuji. I went there in 1985, exactly this very month, 33 years ago. It was my first stop on a 9-month pilgrimage in Asia that the center graciously, generously paid for so I could visit some places like train at Bukokuji and another temple in Japan. During those 3 months I spent at Bukokuji with Tongan Roshi, now Roshi, someone persuaded him at a tea break to tell the story of this where he fell off the mountain. He had been hiking up and there were these low mountains or high hills above the temple, above Bukokuji, and he had strayed too close to the edge of a cliff and fell off. And he was caught, his fall was broken by this only tree, a tree branch that jutted out. It saved his life, for sure. He did sustained a hip injury that bothered him for the rest of his life. But this is the best part of the story. He said there over tea, he said on the way down, before he hit the tree branch, before it caught him, he said in his mind, he thought, ego unnecessary. Now back to when he was a child, his father died also when he was young. So by the time he was a teenager, he was an orphan. We're continuing here with Pat Simon's account in the old Zenbo. When he was about 12 years old, a deep questioning arose in him. Whenever he felt the wind or looked at the sky, he would ask himself, what is there deep down beneath the surface of things? When he would eat an orange, for instance, he would not think of its taste or color, but would wonder, what is there? There is something I feel but don't understand. I sense its presence but can't take hold of it. His inability to answer these questions was a source of such increasing discontentment that he always felt separated from people and things. As an older teenager, Tangen San began to listen to symphonic music, especially music of Beethoven, Liszt, and Bach. In their works, he found peace, harmony, and a feeling of oneness, but these feelings did not carry over into other activities. The only exception was when he was alone in nature. There, he found he could reach a similar sort of calm. But with people, he still encountered the same sense of estrangement. Since this sense of separation extended even to his own family and close friends, his mental pain was intense. I have another document here. This is a translation into English of a talk he gave called Awaken to the True Self. And I'm turning to... Oh, here's one thing. Excuse me. Just this statement, I think, is quite insightful. Self-insightful. He said, from childhood on, as though in search of something, I was always a rather rebellious youth. From childhood on, as though in search of something, I was always a rather rebellious youth. So interesting that he would understand rebellion, this rebelliousness, youthful rebellion, as in search of something. I think back to not just myself, but a couple of other guys in high school who were the big troublemakers and acting out, and one of them I heard many years later had become a minister of some kind. Back to Pat Simon's thing. At 18, during a vacation from school, he was at a seaside resort where, alone, he climbed a small mountain. And now I'll pick up Tangen Roshi's own words. As I climbed that day, I could think of nothing but my own selfishness. Shedding tears, I repeatedly reflected and repented. I'm no good. I'm no good. As I made the 30-minute ascent up the mountain trail. Then he got to the top of the mountain, and he said, beyond, the valley stretched to the Pacific Ocean. Transfixed by the mountain landscape, the wind blew into me from the valley floor, and I felt as if I were growing bigger and bigger. In retrospect, we could say that I was experiencing the reality of being one with and cared for by all things of this world, experiencing the greatness of the life I have been given. But at the time, I just felt myself becoming bigger and the sensation of being protected by everyone. It's beautiful. At that point, I couldn't contain myself anymore, so in a giant voice, I shouted my name 7 or 8 times into the far-off horizon. Since that time, a bright and changed world unfolds before me. For 1 or 2 months after the experience, everything, down to the pebbles along the roadside, brilliantly glistened. You could say this was a tip-of-the-tongue taste of Kensho, one of these marvelous oceanic feelings that can enormously bolster one's faith mind. He says, it is an intimate, friendly life. And then he writes, although I felt at the time that I would often return to pay my respects to that dear, beloved mountain, I have not been back even once. Just more about that, because these things can be so, they can affect one's journey through the rest of one's life. I remember well being filled with the knowledge of being together, part of the same life. At the same time, I still knew nothing of Zazen and such, but the walls separating me from others had collapsed. My life had become a world somehow without discrimination, so I felt as if I could even chat with the chirping sparrows. Later, when I began to do Zazen, I could receive the teachings of my master, which I had sought since childhood, with a completely open and receptive mind. Yeah, he was in a very, he had been primed for the Dharma and could just drink in what his teacher had was teaching. Without theoretical understanding and without being able to explain what happened, I had tapped into the very joy of life, and I determined from then on to dedicate my life to repaying my gratitude. As it was wartime, I felt that the one thing I could do immediately to help was to go first before the bullet. Propelled by the spirit of helping others, I joined the army. Now, just let me back up a little bit here and read from this same account of his, this talk translated into English called Awaken to the Self. This is just about the same time where we just left off. He said, when I was 18 or 19 years old, I resolved to become like a chair. That was because a chair doesn't refuse its services to anybody. It just takes care of the sitter and lets him rest his legs. At this time in Japan, during the war, or right before the war, a chair would still have been something of a novelty in Japan, because traditionally the people of Japan would sit with their legs tucked under them in the what we call the seiza position, rather than having chairs. So this, the idea of a chair, having seen a chair, prompted this kind of reflection about a chair. After it has served its purpose, no one gets up and thinks or offers words of kindness to the chair. It will more likely get kicked out of the way. What's more, the chair doesn't grumble or complain or bear a grudge, but just takes whatever is given. When there's a job to be done, it puts forth all its energy without picking and choosing according to its desires. I was thinking, wouldn't it be great to have such a heart? So to use a very common Zen phrase, just bow and serve. You can see what an uncommon young man he was, that already he had this kind of an aspiration to be such a pure server of others. I wrote on a big sheet of paper, "Be like a chair," and every day took note of how close I came. If even a little dissatisfaction arose, I would regard that as an embarrassing state of mind for a chair. I think a better than embarrassing, a better translation would be disgraceful. A disgraceful state of mind for a chair. I considered how thoroughly I was of use to others. A chair doesn't plop itself down on top of the sitter, right? The endeavor was not at all forced or unnatural. It arose from life itself and was enjoyable, not painful. And that's when he climbed that mountain and had that transforming experience that we just read about. When I think back to when I was that age, being like a chair was the last thing that would have occurred to me. So he had a good start, this young Tongan son, in terms of the purity of his karma, his character. Now, back to Pat Simon's more linear account that I've been following. He left off saying that he joined the army. So this must have been 1945. Toward the latter part of World War II, he came of age for the military and enlisted in the Air Force. He didn't do so out of hatred for America. He just wanted to protect those he loved. It's an interesting distinction, but we don't have time to explore that. But I take him at his word. He really did say, he said that to me too. He didn't hate America. He wanted to protect those he loved. And then he eventually volunteered for a kamikaze suicide squadron. He had a long period of training for this suicide mission. And in the day for his first and last flight came up. But just a few hours before he was to take off, word came that peace had been declared. This must have been in the early August of 1945. The good fortune of this event hit him with so strongly that he vowed to devote his life to saving others, and from that day he felt he was beginning a whole new existence. Imagine the very day that peace was declared, that he was set to go up in the kamikaze mission. Same day. Now, this is something I just was reminded of this morning when I reread this. At the close of the war, he was captured by the Russians and, before being repatriated, spent a year in a Russian prisoner of war camp. He was not treated harshly by his guards, although his only clothes were lightweight and there was little food, one or two potatoes a day, in a cold climate. He regards the event as one which did him more good than harm. Upon returning to Japan, Tangensan's desire to help others grew, but he still could find no peace of mind. An older friend suggested that he begin Zazen, and he did so, attending three sesshins at a nunnery whose abbess was a disciple of Harada Roshi. After his third sesshin, the abbess said that he should be practicing Zen among men and should go to attend sesshin at Harada Roshi's monastery. At his first sesshin under Harada Roshi, Tangensan found that he believed everything the Roshi said. How true, he exclaimed to himself over and over. One sesshin followed another. He became a lay resident at Harada Roshi's monastery, but he was practicing too strenuously. He would sit far into the night on the mountain behind the monastery, and at one point made a practice of going to a bamboo forest and tying himself to a large bamboo, gripping its trunk and roaring, "Moo! Moo! Moo!" And then Pat writes here that he commented about this manner of practicing, he commented, "Too much ego." He slowly lost energy and weight. Food in post-war Japan was scarce and poor. After 2 years, a doctor told him to stop sitting. Tangen-san was so weak he couldn't even grip with his hands. Pains would shoot between his heart and abdomen. Still, Haradoroshi told him not to quit zazen, but merely do it quietly without straining himself. Tangen-san followed the Roshi's advice, as well as that of an older monk who invited Tangen-san to return with him to his mountain temple in the north. This he did, coming back to the monastery for the 6 sesshins held there annually. A year passed. During this time, he could sit all he wanted to and gradually began to do 108 prostrations on a daily basis. Some of you have heard me say that this is I've been told it's a standard practice in Korean Zen, that the first thing you do when you get up in the morning before sitting is 108 prostrations. By the end of the year, he had developed real faith, and Pat quotes him as saying, "not in the head, in the hara," and naturally became a monk. Naturally is Tangen-san's word. And his strength had begun to return. There's so many accounts we have available to us from China and Korea and Japan of monks who were beset with serious illnesses, who just sat through the illness and found themselves somewhat miraculously cured. So then another 2 years passed. Now he'd been sitting for 5 years. The June session was approaching, and this time he was determined to break through. During the session, he slept very little, sitting up most of the nights. And then on the 6th night, with Mu still unresolved, he hid a knife in the sleeve of his robe, determined to do away with himself if he did not get Kensho by the end of the session. He sat up all night. In the zazen period just before the morning doksan, a monitor came up behind Tangen-san and whispered in his ear, "You will surely get Kensho at this doksan." Now, that's something that I would kill my monitors if they ever came up behind someone and said that in their ear. But you can't argue with success, and this worked for him. The young Tangen-san's problem was not an over. It was a different kind of ego. It was ego where he felt himself inadequate, or he felt himself. We heard him saying, "You're no good. You're no good," and for him, a person of an entirely different culture than ours, this seems to have worked. Suddenly, it says, all of his doubts melted away, and the answer to his childhood question came up with great force. Yes, there is something. As soon as he walked into Doksan, the Roshi smiled and exclaimed, "Wonderful." Then he asked Tangen-san a number of questions, all of which he was able to answer promptly. And this is also something important. In commenting on the story, after Tangen-san had told Pat and Roshi and Hugh and Bob, after he told the story, he said, "But it was only a small Kensho." He said that laughing and apologized to us for telling such a poor story. It's a typical Japanese self-effacement. And then here's a little, the end of this old Zenbo account. Tangen-san left Kyoto early this morning to return to his home temple. He awoke before we did and stole quietly out. sensei, that's Kaplow, sensei told us when we got up that he, sensei, had arisen at about 2 a.m. to go to the bathroom and had seen Tangen-san sitting in zazen on his sleeping mat. That too, there's so many stories of great masters who, after multiple enlightenment experiences, would still sit up into the night, through the night, and Tangen-san was one of those. When I first met Tangen Roshi and then also the second time, my overwhelming impression was of him as someone of extraordinary joy and energy. He was just a fountain of joyous energy. And in this article of his called Awakened to the True Self, there's a passage here that I think you can read this as bearing on that. By the way, this article, Awakened to the True Self, is one that I've used, I've commented on in two Taishos, 1987 and 1996. So I'm just plucking out a couple things here. He talks about joyful mind. Joyful mind is the mind that cannot help but feel gratitude. It is not that you feel thankful because you're supposed to feel thankful, but rather that you cannot help but feel thankful. You feel so much gratitude that it spills over as joy. And then from that boundless joy, kindness arises. Kindness which is born from thoroughly exhausting all of one's small self and merging to become one with others. This is parental mind. And that was my experience with Tangen Roshi in the 3 months I spent with him, was this tremendous kindness. Besides the joy, the joyous energy, there was this kindness, solicitousness. It's a very different style of teaching than what I had been subjected to here under Roshi Kaplow. Roshi Kaplow was harsh. He was critical. He did not suffer fools. He often chewed me out for this or that. And then I got none of that in Bukokuji. Now, to be fair, I heard it rumored that Tangen Roshi was harder on the monks he had ordained, his own monks, than he was on those of us who were there from had been working with other teachers. But it was such a sense of another teacher, I think Yasutani Roshi maybe, said the purpose of Zen is to develop a tender heart. And that's what I saw in Tangen Roshi. Great sensitivity and love. We don't talk about love. We don't use the word much in Zen because we emphasize what love grows out of, which is oneness. But definitely there was love. The whole temple was bathed in love from him. And gratitude. And playfulness. Childlike is another word that comes Roshi Kappo used to use that for people who long trained in Japan. There was a playfulness. There were several of us, several Americans who were, well, two or three. Yeah, three. There, when I was there, there were three of us from the United States. And one day he proudly had one of his monks bring in at the tea break a great big box, a fairly flat box, and he opened it up for us all to share, and there were these big, fat American donuts. And he says, "American donuts!" There, too, the attention to his foreign guests and wanting to make them feel at home. But most of all, I remember him when he went through the Zendo. He spoke very little English. He must have lost some since Kaplosan had been there. But going through the Zendo and saying, in English, saying, "Only doing," just like that. "Only doing." Which, of course, means just this, just the sitting, just the hand washing, just the walking, nothing extra, no thoughts to get in the way, only doing. And the other thing, we'd say, I consulted my diary, I kept a diary there, and so I was reminded that he would also say, "Isho kenmei," means with all your heart. Simple. You don't need to know a lot of any language to get across the essence of this practice. We have to wrap this up now. There's a terrific photo of Tangen Roshi on the altar. In about, 20 minutes or so, we'll be having the memorial service. If you haven't had a chance, please go up to the altar and take a good look at that face, that the deep repose and clarity of that man. And we'll stop now and recite the four vows. Without number,
I bow to the great endless wide passions. I bow to a brute dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to the great endless blind passions. I bow to the uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the rhythmic way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to the great endless blind. grace beyond measure I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow